The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Milwaukee Brewers podcast joining you on a Tuesday. The Milwaukee Brewers season is over. This you know by now. They were swept in two games by the Los Angeles Dodgers in the wild card round of the refashioned Major League Baseball playoffs. It was a strange season, had kind of a, I guess, predictable ending based on what you saw during the regular season. And now we turn our attention to what comes next. Very difficult questions to answer. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the Journal Sentinel Brewers podcast, and on the other line, I have both Tom Hodricourt and Todd Rosiak, Brewers beat reporters for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They had a front row seat, sort of a front row seat, to what they were allowed to see this season. A lot of Zoom interviews, a lot of remote baseball coverage, and a lot of weirdness. Guys, I find myself, I look forward to the start of the 2021 season in my head when the Brewers mount one of those banners on the facade that indicates they were a playoff team in 2020. And if we have fans in the stands in 2021, which I'm not even sure we're going to have, but if we do, I am so curious to know what the reaction will be to that, because this was such a strange playoff qualification, a losing team at 29-31 going into the playoffs. I don't know how people are going to feel about it. I don't know how you guys feel about it. It can't be seen as a success per se, but I don't even know how you measure success. So, I mean, I guess like off the top, was this a successful season? I mean, how do we even begin to evaluate what we saw in 2020?
I think it's successful just for the standpoint they got it in. Honestly, I mean, yeah. How many of us going into the season were saying, oh, this is going to be done within 2 weeks. This is going to be done within a month. There's no way they're going to be able to play all the games. And they did, you know, you look at the record, in my opinion, that's they definitely underachieved. There were many reasons for that we can go into. You know, there's always going to be an asterisk next to that season, next to the season in the record books, regardless. But they did get into the playoffs, backed into it as they did. Obviously the numbers were not pretty. The offense stunk, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they got the season in and they got in the playoffs. So it could have been much worse, I guess. Tom, what do you think?
Well, the getting into the playoffs was key, just because I think if you didn't get into the playoffs, the teams that did not, they have to be asking themselves, wow, we went through all that and didn't even make the playoffs. And they were expanded playoffs at that. So I think pretty much everybody that did not make it considers it a failure of some sorts, of some magnitude. I mean, I can only imagine how the Giants and Phillies felt about the way their season ended. Up to the very last day, if they would have won a game, they could have, either one of them, they could have gotten in ahead of the Brewers, but they just couldn't do it, and so they didn't get in. You know, under the rules that were established by MLB, the Brewers qualified. You had to be in the top eight, and there were some tiebreaker things in there that would come into play as well if that's what it came down to. So, you know, they got in, but I don't think that you feel great about any season in which you never were over 500, not even for one day. And so, yes, the Brewers were happy that they can say they made the playoffs for the third straight year, first time in franchise history. But I don't think they were happy about the way they played. I don't think they were happy about their final record. I don't think they were happy about the way they got into the playoffs and then how they performed once they got in. You know, they were in such disarray at the end with their pitching staff all banged up and their offense just, you know, not performing well. So, you know, when you look at it, they lost to the Dodgers 4-2 and 3-0. I mean, it's not like they got stomped, but they just couldn't score runs. And it was very peculiar what was going on in the NL Central at the end of the season. With two runs, the Brewers were the second highest scoring of the four NL Central teams in the postseason. The Reds, I can only imagine how the Reds feel. They waited 7 years to get in the playoffs, made all those moves to improve their team, and then they couldn't score a run in 22 innings.
And not for lack of opportunity. They had guys on third base with nobody out on multiple occasions. It was like a wall.
It started, didn't it start like the very first inning they had, like the bases loaded and couldn't score? And then the Cubs scored one run in two games. So, You know, either the NL Central pitching was just the most fantastic pitching ever, or the offenses weren't very good. I think it's probably some combination of the two. But it wasn't NL Central pitching these teams were facing in the playoffs, and they still couldn't score. So it's a whole lot of people scratching their heads about what went on offensively throughout the game. You know, some teams did fine. But some teams, you know, some teams and some players really struggled.
And I think if we're grading on a curve offensively, I mean, obviously the Brewers are still at the bottom here. So you have to be, I think, disappointed with them offensively if you're trying to look at them and evaluate them. But the biggest thing, I think ultimately the biggest storyline in the offseason will be Christian Yelich and what happens next. And I think with any player, we're obviously going to kind of throw our hands up when we try to evaluate this 60-game season with the, you know, with the interrupted spring training and in Yelich's case, coming off of an injury where he missed the last part of the 2019 season, obviously, he signs a massive contract. I mean, there were a lot of variables in play for him, but to see him go from an MVP candidate to being, you know, one of the weaker hitters, you know, in the Central was something that nobody was prepared for. And he's still one of the best hitters on this team because the Brewers had offensive struggles across the board, but trying to figure out where he goes from here, I think, is probably going to be one of the things everyone's focused on. Is he not the player that we saw in 2018, 2019? I would think we're assuming he's certainly better than what we saw for 60 games in 2020. What do you think? I mean, what comes next with Christian Yelich? I mean, is that going to be scrutinized, analyzed? I mean, it seems like he's going to come into 2021 with a lot of pressure all of a sudden. You know, now it's going to be prove that you are, in fact, an MVP candidate and not the guy who struggled so mightily this season. What do you think the kind of, I guess, the talking points are with Christian Yelich?
I think it's interesting because, you know, coming out of 2018, going into 2019, I would argue he faced way more pressure because what were all the questions? How can you possibly live up to your 2018 expectations, your 2018 season? And it made him mad. It motivated him. And look what happened. You know, he was on MVP pace again until he broke his kneecap and eventually finished second. So, you know, this is a guy that's already proven that he can take something, let it motivate him, and become even better in the end result. So I have no question that in my mind that he's probably a little rattled by the way things went this year. You know, on multiple occasions, he referenced him sucking and not being a good baseball player, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously that's hyperbole, but I think that, you know, the ultimate end result of all this stuff is 2020, you know, I mean, you chalk it up to 2020. If you're Christian Yelich, I think you go into the offseason, you take some time, you just decompress, you get away from it, clear your mind, and you start fresh. You know, I asked him this question the last time we had spoken to him on Zoom, you know, just kind of curious to see what his offseason plans were. And, you know, he didn't even mention the clearing his mind thing. It was just, you know, I'm going to do my normal offseason and do my normal preparation and get ready the way I always have. And you know, we still don't know what 2021 is going to look like. It's, you know, it seems right now like it's not going to be a normal quote unquote season, but you have to prepare like it may be if you're a player, I would think. So, you know, all that just to say that I would never, just based off of that, the way he responded to that 2018 season, I would never underestimate Christian Yelich or his motivation and I certainly would not say that, you know, be worried about, oh, you know, is he trending downward as a player? Has he already reached his high point? I don't think any of that stuff really registers. I just think it was an aberration of a year. He'll have a normal off season, as normal as it can be. And, you know, you turn the page and you try to start fresh in 2021. And I think you're going to see more of the Christian Yelich that we became accustomed to in 2018 and 2019.
Yeah, David Stearns in his season wrap-up Zoom on Monday called it the perfect storm for Christian Yelich of things combining to get the result he got. And he mentioned something that that Andy Haynes, the hitting coach, had mentioned to us earlier in the season, that he went 10 months without playing from breaking his kneecap in September to all of a sudden playing in late July. You know, he didn't play hardly any in spring training because they were bringing him and Braun along real slow, and then they were going to ramp him up right at the end and then be ready for the season. And then we never got to that point. In mid-March, they shut everything down. So then he sat for 3.5 months, and he was out in L.A. too, where they were pretty serious about quarantining. And, you know, it's not like he could go out and find eight other major leaguers and get a game together. That just wasn't happening. He even mentioned to us that he was playing catch with his brother out in the street just to have something to do. So I do think there was a lot of long inactivity there. And then all of a sudden that 3-week summer camp, you know, he didn't look very good there and they had to rush through it. And then I think 1-for-27 happened to him. He started 1-for-27 and that put him in a little bit of I don't know if I would call it panic mode, but just trying to play this futile game of catch up that never really happened. And so one thing we've learned about Christian in the few years that he's been on the team is if he doesn't actually have motivation, he'll invent some motivation. And he had that R word, remember, Todd, last spring, regression. Everybody's regression, the R word. So if there's not actually obvious motivation out there, he'll invent some. Well, he's got obvious motivation out there now. And a motivated Christian Yelich is something the team really wants to have because he really focuses then. So, you know, if he had never been a good player and then he did this, I'd be worried. But this is the only time he's ever not done well, you know. So you have to say it's an aberration. And, you know, Keston Hiura falls under that a little bit too. He doesn't have the long track record that Christian had, but he had always hit everywhere he'd ever been, including amateur baseball. So got guys that have always hit and then didn't do well in this 2 months, I think you give them the benefit of the doubt. And it's not like they were the only guys either. You know, the guy that beat Christian Yelich out for MVP last year, Cody Bellinger, he didn't play very well this year either. So a whole bunch, you know, to their credit, a whole bunch of guys did do well, but then a whole bunch did not. I mean, you look at that Cubs team and Rizzo and Bryan and Baez, they were all brutal, you know what? And so I just think you got to give them all the benefit of the doubt. But I do wonder, like Todd just mentioned, if we're going to be back to normal in the spring or if they're going to be adjusting to more COVID protocols, and that will not be good for anybody involved. I can tell you that right now.
Right. If we assume that Keston Hiura and Christian Yelich return to, you know, to being strong offensive forces, and I think that's something Brewers fans can reasonably expect will probably happen, at least close to what they were before, there's still a question of where the rest of the offense is going to come from. And when they signed Christian Yelich prior to the season, you know, that to me kind of caught me off guard. It's okay, well, they feel that they're comfortable going forward next few years. They're going to be really pushing as many chips to the center of the table as they can to really go for it. And then we saw an offseason where, you know, for the most part, I don't know if cost-cutting is the way you look at this offseason, but they were definitely doing things creatively where they weren't going after top-line free agents, as has been their custom, and trying to find some maybe high-variance guys a little off the beaten path. Obviously, a lot of those moves didn't work out. We've talked about that. But you know, they probably, in most scenarios, would have worked out. Some of them would have worked out more than they did. But with word that the Brewers could potentially even lower payroll some more going into next year, understandably because of the financial constraints of this pandemic, you just got to wonder, where's the offense going to come from? There aren't even many guys on the free agent market. You know, maybe JT Realmuto is the top free agent prize out there, plays a position the Brewers could use, a catcher, but they're probably realistically not going to go after a guy like that. So it's hard to imagine where they're going to be able to fix this offense, the challenges David Stearns has in front of him trying to add bats. How do you guys look at that? I mean, do you see it as much of a, it seems to me like a really very difficult to solve puzzle. Maybe there's more optimism than I give it credit for. What do you guys think?
I think the perfect scenario for a team, a small market team that cannot add more payroll, that needs some impact bats, or at least expanding the offense, the threat that the offense can present the opponent. This is the off season where you really entertain trading Josh Hader. You know, it's not like you're in a hurry to get rid of the guy, but you're in maximum bargaining position. There will be teams interested in him. His price is going to start going up significantly as the seasons go by. You know, you saw some, again, you know, two months asterisk of a season, but you know, you're starting to see some signs with him that perhaps he could be trending in the wrong direction. Again, you know, take that with a grain of salt, take that for what it's worth. But to me, it's like all signs are pointing to the fact that if it's going to get done, it would be this offseason if David Stearns can get, you know, a package for him that would satisfy at least one of the need positions, if not, you know, two. And those two need positions, of course, are first and third base. And we're not even considering catcher, which looks like another need position. And I'm sure we'll get into that later. But, you know, if you can swing a deal for Josh Hader, pick up a few guys that you feel are going to help you immediately moving forward, knowing that Devin Williams is in the background here and you can shift him to the closer's role. You know, you've got other guys who you can slide into that setup role. As you know, bullpens are always fluid. I'm sure there'll be some moves there as well. I think you do it because they're just not going to be able to, with the drop in revenue this year, make any of those big ticket moves. Tom, do you agree, disagree?
Well, it's definitely the one area that they could trade from and not blow their team sky high. You know, when you trade players like that, you either deal from areas of strength or areas of weakness. And if you deal from areas of weakness, then it's just, you know, you're robbing Peter to pay Paul. It's probably not going to be something that's going to work out in the long run. But they do, the bullpen, you know, is definitely their area of strength. And, you know, so many teams struggle with their bullpens this year too. But the Brewers now are on a several season run of having very good bullpens. And they do change some pieces out. You know, we heard a lot of Josh Hader trade rumors at the trade deadline this year, and I consistently wrote and tweeted, it's not going to happen. It makes no sense to do it now. You know, they had one more month where they could use him to try to get to the playoffs, and they did. And then you go into the offseason where there's no trade deadline. There's no pressure. You control the action. More teams are probably going to jump in. Because they're building for next year, not trying to, you know, patch up stuff for the last month run this year. So it makes all the sense in the world to do it this winter. And no, it made no sense to do it then, and they didn't. He has three more years of control. I mean, I'm not sure when the last time a reliever of his caliber has ever been traded with 3 years of control. You know, and the Cubs gave up some really good players to get Aroldis Chapman. He did not have three more years of control. And so you got to get a bunch back. If you're going to trade a reliever with 3 years of control, because he was a Super 2 arbitration player. So even though he was in arbitration this year, he's got three more years of control. He's in the prime of his career too. So you need to ask for a lot and you need to get a lot. But to me, that's the only impact move they could make to maybe pick up some dynamic offensive help that could really help their team going forward, because they do not have offensive help coming from the farm system next year. David Stearns, you know, admitted what we already knew yesterday, that he doesn't. All of their position player prospects are young guys who need some more time. And a lot of them were at Cap Appleton too, but they still didn't get the full year of minor league development. That would have been nice. So, I mean, I think we're going to be hearing a lot of trade rumors on Josh Hader this winter. And this time, unlike August 31, I think we need to pay attention to them.
Yeah, I actually would be really surprised, actually, if Josh Hader were on the Brewers coming into the 2021 season. You mentioned the Super 2 status. That's a huge factor. I mean, like Todd said, he's going to get paid exponentially more over the course of the next three seasons. And you also mentioned the trade deadline in the middle of the 2020 season. One aspect to that that maybe doesn't get talked about is the restrictions on scouting. Guys weren't able to just go to other camps to watch these minor leaguers play. I mean, it would have been a real risky move to trade a high-priced trade asset for guys that you haven't fully scouted. So this offseason, I think we're going to see, like you said, a ton of chatter about that. Maybe other guys too from the bullpen. Maybe Corey Knebel. Certainly, I doubt Devin Williams. But if you buy into the idea that bullpens are high variance situations, maybe even they entertain offers for another guy with a ton of control, being Devin Williams. Certainly, I doubt that. I think that's one of the reasons why Josh Hader is, I wouldn't say expendable, but you know you've got a powerful guy at the back end of the bullpen. Williams, I think, has picked up a little bit of steam in the Rookie of the Year conversation in the last stretch of the season. His numbers were incredible. Of course, he was left off the roster in that Dodgers series because of a minor injury that they didn't end up needing him as the games played out, but that did look like a pretty devastating loss at the outset of the playoffs. Have you thought about the Rookie of the Year thing at all? Is Devin Williams a top two candidate here? There's so many guys. I think Jake Cronenworth of the Padres is probably still the favorite, but I don't know anymore. It's such a small sample. I really don't know which direction people are going to go. Maybe his video game numbers get him the Rookie of the Year. Is that possible?
I did not have a Rookie of the Year vote this year. And if you would have asked me this question several weeks ago, I probably would have said, yeah, I think Cronenworth's going to win it. But I think in the last several weeks, Devin Williams got so much national press, rightfully so, for what he was doing and, shining a light on the numbers that he was putting up, the video game numbers, like everybody's been saying, that I think his candidacy really caught some steam, and it would not surprise me if he won it, honestly. Again, I don't know anybody that's voting for it, and I haven't talked to anybody about it.
I am.
All right, okay. Then you know you're not supposed to divulge your ballot, but you know,
right, I have to recuse myself from that conversation because I did have Rookie of the Year. You know, there's no question he had to be in the conversation. He had to be on it. You know, the Rookie of the Year has three names on it. Cy Young has five, but Rookie of the Year has three. So is he top three worthy? I think we've all decided that he's, you know, got to be in that conversation. So I'm not going to talk any more about that because I don't want to tip off how I voted. But I do think the reliever of the year in the National League is definitely in play. And that's like an MLB, like a panel award. Baseball Digest already gave it to him, but that's not the official one. That's not the one that Josh Hader won the last 2 years. I think, oddly enough, I think it might be between Devin Williams and a former Brewer, Drew Pomerantz. Pomerantz had not given up a run all season until his last outing.
Which the Giants took the lead and really should have won that game, if not for a Trent Grisham home run in the ninth, which got the Brewers into the playoffs.
Right. So I think a reliever of the year might be between Devin Williams and Drew Pomerantz. that's pretty ironic. But
Jeremy Jeffress would probably be in the mix too for the Cubs, speaking of former Brewers.
He had a good year. There's no question he had a good year, and they wouldn't have won. They probably wouldn't have finished first without him because he ended up being the closer for most of the year. You know, you mentioned another name in there that I think we should throw out, Corey Knebel. He made $5 million this year, and even though he started trending better towards the end after Tommy John surgery, and he certainly did not get the correct ramp up that you would want with the pandemic. But, you know, if here's the team looking to save money and use money in other areas, if they, Josh Hader made $4 million this year, he's going to make $5 or $6 million next year. Corey Knebel made $5 million this year. If they trade Josh Hader and non-tender Corey Knebel, there's $10 million in savings right there that they could use for, you know, some offensive help. So, let's keep in mind, I don't know what their appetite is to offer Corey Knebel another contract. Do you, Todd?
No, I don't. I mean, I've knocked that around in my head, and to me, out of all the seasons where you feel like you need sure things, you know, you need to know that the money you're spending is going to be utilized correctly, if that makes sense. If you're going to get production for what you're paying for, you know, if Corey Knebel's salary is not going to go down, he was trending in the right direction toward the end of the season, but to me, there's still red flags there. You know, this is not a guarantee that he's going to ever come back to being the Corey Knebel that we knew before he blew out his elbow. You know, obviously they have their own internal discussions and they know best, but to me, if I'm spending the money, I'd be very nervous about bringing him back at that kind of salary. And because there's just the potential there for it not to go well. And then you're locked into him for another year and you've got a guy, how can you use him, et cetera, et cetera. I just feel like there's too many question marks there in another season that's going to be full of uncertainty. I think I would look in a different direction, but who knows? I mean, maybe he's kind of a security blanket for them. They feel confident that, you know, with another off season behind him, strengthening, rehabbing, all that kind of stuff, that they feel like he'll be a more of a bounce back candidate. But to me, I'd be very nervous about giving him, you know, $5-6 million and bringing him back again and expecting him to be the Corey Knebel of old.
I think it's way more likely that they would try to cut a lesser deal with him to bring him back.
Right.
Then it would be his decision to either take it or go out on the market. He's
right.
Got 1 year.
What his comfort level is coming back to Milwaukee, which I'm sure is very high. And we don't have any indications that, he was unhappy with anything there. I mean, they stuck by him and they let him get ready at his own pace and everything. So, yeah. by all accounts, it seems like he's comfortable here and enjoyed playing for the Brewers. So,
yeah, it just wasn't fair to him the way he had to try to come back with no minor league rehab. But there has to be just enough uncertainty in there to make him a non-tender candidate. I'm not saying they're going to do it. I'm saying he's a candidate. And especially at that salary, and especially for a team looking to either cut their payroll or reallocate it. Because I was thinking the other day, if they traded Hader and non-tendered Knebel, and then you don't pick up the option on Ryan Braun, there's $20 million in savings with three guys.
Yep.
Yeah, and I got to wonder if to fill some of these spots on the roster, if their payroll really is going down, they're gonna turn to veterans more than maybe they have in the past. There's a lot of veterans on the market. A guy like Justin Turner, who's 36 years old but could play third base, might be the type of option. I mean, we've talked about Ryan Braun. If they have the designated hitter again next year, maybe they bring him back. I mean, those are, I guess, more creative options on the other side of the ball, on the offensive side, that they could pursue. You know, Todd, you mentioned catcher. That's one of the two positions that really I'm probably most interested in this offseason to know what the team is going to do. They do have a couple prospects waiting in the wings, Feliciano and Peyton Henry, that could potentially contribute maybe midway through 2021, maybe 2022, which makes me think they might try to maybe, you know, bring Narvaez back as much as he struggled in 2020. He's not that player. He's not this bad. You'd like to think there'd be a bounce back there. Maybe
well,
they get through.
Let's. I want to ask Todd a question about Narvaez. Todd, from David Stern's press season wrap up, when we asked him about Narvaez, what feel did you get about whether he's coming back or not?
Yeah. We're going to have to do our due diligence, basically, with the line on that one. So there's going to be a whole lot of computers smoking in the background there at Miller Park. You know, the baseball data people and all that kind of stuff, crunching numbers and everything, but was not a ringing endorsement. Let's just say that.
No, but I think they're equally nervous to cut bait with him, and then he goes somewhere and he's good.
No question about it. And again, it goes back to the whole, you know, this is an asterisk season, and you know, like JR said, he can't possibly be this bad. I mean.
He never has been that bad. I mean, he was a total non-contributor often. You know, 2020 was just the most bizarre world. So Omar Narvaez goes from an offensive catcher with a terrible defensive reputation to a pretty good defensive catcher who can't hit. So, I mean, can we get a more bizarro world than what happened to him? He became Henry Blanco all of a sudden.
There's a pull. I also think everybody became a better defensive catcher because the zones expanded.
Yeah. it was a lot easier to frame this year because you basically didn't have to.
Well, I never looked at the final numbers, but about midway through the season, Omar was the best framer in baseball, which is incredible to see.
So it just is one of the, you know, 2020 will forever be known as the year when nothing was the same. It certainly wasn't with Omar Narváez. But the other thing that we should bring out there is to get rid of any person, you have to have an alternative, you know. And they don't have one in-house, you know. Manny Pena is getting up there in age and coming off of knee surgery. Jacob Nottingham is unproven. And they have some really good catching prospects down in the system, Feliciano and Peyton Henry, but those guys aren't going to be here for a few years. So you would have to think you could go out and get something better if you cut him. So I don't envy them on that decision. If they keep him and he has another terrible year, they will never hear the end of it. But if they cut him and he goes elsewhere, you know, and does better, and then they don't have a good catching situation in his place, they're going to feel bad about that too. I was watching playoff baseball last night and then also looking at rosters for today, and I was saying to myself, I wonder if they'd like to have either Jesus Aguilar or G-Man Choi back right now.
Man, I know we would.
Oh, yeah, those guys are fun.
Yeah, just from a selfish thing.
But, I mean, considering they ended up with Jed Jerko as their first baseman, and he certainly hit okay, but he's not a first baseman. You know, and the players they traded for those guys, Brad Miller, they traded G-Man Choi for Brad Miller. He got released like 6 weeks later. And then the guy that they got for Aguilar, Jacob Faria, got released at the end of this year. So those two guys are the starting first baseman for two playoff teams. And the Brewers don't have anything in return for them still in their organization and don't know what they're going to do at first base. So I'm not saying they shouldn't have made those trades. I'm just saying you just don't know how stuff's going to work out sometimes. Sometimes, you know, when they traded G-Man Choi, they had both Jesus Aguilar and Eric Thames, and there was just didn't look like there was no place for him to play. So, but it's just weird how you go from an area of depth to an area of no depth in seemingly the blink of an eye.
Yeah, I think there's a chance Justin Smoke could have done what Jesus Aguilar has done this year, bounce back and become that power-hitting first baseman. It just didn't work out. And Eric Thames actually is a good example, a guy they let go that maybe didn't have to let go, but he signs with the Nationals and he winds up kind of having a down year. He wasn't really a factor for them, and that team didn't end up going anywhere this season. So first base is just one of those high-variance positions. You could really boom or bust with those guys. Which takes me to another spot on the diamond that's a little different, shortstop, where, you know, you're always trying to stockpile as many quality shortstops in your system as you can. And the Brewers, maybe this is a strength, I'm not entirely sure, but Orlando Arcia had a decent year. He accounts for all of the Brewers' offense in the postseason with a two-run home run off Walker Buehler. So he had another nice moment. Always seems to come up in these clutch situations. I know clutch is largely an invention as a construct we have, but like he really seems to pick his spots. And then he would seemingly be in a battle with Luis Urias for some sort of spot on the roster playing time. Urias, of course, we saw could play multiple positions, but neither one of those guys is the obvious answer going forward. Arcia's getting up there in age and, you know, in salary a little bit. And Urias being the younger guy, I guess, is probably the way I would think the Brewers lean if they had to choose between them. I don't know if they are choosing between them. I don't know what comes next for Orlando Arcia. I think he's kind of a puzzle to me. He sort of is what he is at this point. Do you think the Brewers ultimately move on there or just sort of see how it goes again for another season with the two of them?
I think what happens at third base will maybe have some bearing on that. You know, if the Brewers look around the free agent market and they don't see anybody that they like or they think is a good fit, and they determine that, you know, let's just put Urias there for a year and see how it goes. Certainly he doesn't fit the offensive profile for third base, but he's shown he can be a really good defensive third baseman. So at least you're getting one part of the equation out of the way there. You know, if they feel like, hey, we can roll with Urias most days at third base, then yeah, I think you bring back Orlando Arcia as the shortstop. But you know, that obviously that's going to be determined here in the coming months and all the machinations they do behind the scenes. I think we know what Orlando Arcia is going to be from now on. He's going to be a guy that's going to hit, you know, 240, 250-ish. He's going to have a little bit of pop. He's a pretty darn good defensive shortstop. He's going to make you pull your hair out at times with some horrible at-bats, some dumb throws, that kind of thing. But, you know, you could do worse at shortstop than him. Let's just say that. So, again, it's another decision that they need to make, and it's going to be an interesting one. Tom, do you have any take on that?
Well, I think their infield right now is just is messy, or as David Stearns, I like the word he used yesterday, inelegant. Their infield is inelegant right now, and here's why. They don't really know who the first baseman and third baseman are. And then Hira is a defensive liability at second. His best position is really DH. But we don't even know we're going to have a DH next year. And then is it Urias or Arcia at shortstop? I know for a fact from talking to some people that were wired into the trade talks that they were shopping Arcia as recently as August 31. So even though he was really one of their steadier players in COVID ball, they were still looking to see what they could get for him at the August 31 trade deadline. And if they would have got something, a good offer, I think they would have traded him and just Urias would have been the shortstop. So they've just got to sort all that out. We know, barring something really unforeseen, that next year Christian Yelich is going to be the left fielder, Lorenzo Cain is going to be the center fielder, and Abisail Garcia is going to be the right fielder. They're all signed for next year, and those are the positions that they play. So the outfield is just not in question. But the whole infield and catcher are in question, you know. And there's parts there to fit in, but where are they going to fit them in? You know, they like moving guys around, and they signed a whole bunch of veteran guys that were in timeshares. You know, Eric Sogar, there's a club option on him next year. Do they exercise that just to keep him as a coverall at all those positions? Stearns indicated yesterday that Hira's probably going to stay at second, but might dabble in first base a little bit. And it sounds like, I'm guessing Jerko's coming back. They have an option on him, and why wouldn't you bring him back? He played well, he hit well, and he covers a lot of different positions. But they've kind of figured out that infield puzzle. They really do. And Urias, you know, I think they would have liked to have seen more from him this year. They don't really know quite what they have in him at this particular point in time. They think he's going to be good in the long haul. He's still a young player. But right now, what he's ready to do next year, I don't know. And I don't think they know.
Another sort of element to that is if the DH does continue on in the National League, which I think we all sort of assume will be the case, Ryan Braun decides to retire, not come back. You know, Keston Hira might be a DH. I mean, obviously, you don't want to pigeonhole a guy into just a hitter. You want him to be able to serve a spot in the infield if you can. But, you know, maybe Jed Jerko or Luis Urias is your second baseman, and Keston Hira, for the most part, is a DH. It was an adventure again this season. Granted, it's, you know, you can't blame any evaluation, you know, shortcomings this year, I don't think, for any player. But Keston Hira's defense has been iffy, you know, his whole career at this point in the big league level. And certainly that was the case again this year. I mean, maybe he's a guy who goes to DH full time and they sign a slugging first baseman or some version of a slugging first baseman. Urias is a second baseman. Maybe Jerko's at third. I mean, there are some options there. It's just hard to know what the final piece is or the final two pieces are to make the whole thing fall into place.
Well, I think Todd can agree with this. It was kind of funny, some of the death stares that Keston Hira got from Jed Jerko this year when Jerko would, like, you know, have to rescue a throw that shouldn't have been that errant. Am I right about that, Todd?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I think it's also part of the second baseman coming out of Jed Jerko being like, dude, what are you doing? Like, I played that position for how many games and, you know, how many games in my career, and I never had this many trouble or this much trouble as you're having throwing the ball 50 feet over to first base. It's just, it's really kind of head scratching. And you wonder if now it's, you know, if he's getting the yips a little bit, you know, is he going to become Steve Sachs You would hate to think that. And it's crazy because like the instinct plays, you know, on the shift going into the hole, and you know, like the you know the stretching out and then making the throw on the run, that sort of thing. He looks really good. He makes some really good plays at times, but then it's all the routine stuff. It seems like he's pulling, he's yanking, and that's what starts making you think like, oh man, is he going to get the yips at some point? But yeah, Jerko definitely deserves a bonus for all the throws he saved Hira on, and other guys too. I mean, he made. He made a couple of Arcia plays look really good on the back end. He was for a guy who's not a career first baseman, he definitely was an infielder because he was great at picking short hops and navigating around the bag at first.
That's what made that play that cost him in the game two of the wild card series so fatalistic because. You know, Urias, they had an easy 5-3 double play that would have got Woodruff out of that inning with no runs. And Urias threw a one hopper, and Jerko, who had been saving those throws all year, couldn't save that one, you know. And so just kind of just the way things were going for them at the end. So it would have stayed nothing to nothing until the Dodgers scored because the Brewers weren't going to score. So yeah, so that it's going to be very fascinating to see on opening day next year who's at first, second, short, and third, and catcher. Mm-hmm. Right now, I can tell you the three outfielders, and that's it.
Well, at least the starting pitcher curse seems to have been solved in the shortened season, and we have a pretty good idea who's going to be on the mound on opening day. And Brandon Woodruff, I guess it could be Corbin Burnes, perhaps, but they seem to be okay in the pitching on the pitching side. Before I let you go, we'll have a lot more to talk about, not necessarily next week because I think we'll be taking a little break from the podcast. There are things like watching what Ryan Braun winds up doing, how the labor situation is going to impact things. So there'll be some topics, but before we move on for the season wrap here, is there any last thoughts, any last storylines you guys are following?
Tom, go for it.
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of, you know, we're gonna come up on certain deadlines here after the season where you have to exercise options, the Braun decision. So we're gonna see stuff evolve and get some of the answers that we were talking about today about who's coming back, who's not. They have until the 1st of December to do tenders and stuff like that. So I'm gonna do a story probably for this coming weekend and just taking a look at their whole roster, who has options, who's arbitration eligible, who's signed for next year. They have six players signed for next year. So they got a lot of work to do on their 40-man roster. And so it's just going to be interesting. I think every team's going to struggle with some of their moves because just how much emphasis do you put on a 60-game season, you know? And so it's going to be a very interesting offseason. And then just out in the world, how we're doing with COVID, you know, if there's any more rules changes. David Stearns was telling us yesterday they need to know soon if they're going to have the DH in the National League because it's how you're going to construct your roster, you know. So I don't think they can wait. Baseball is famous for waiting till like just before a season starts to spring all the new rules on you. And they need to declare that DH thing. In my opinion, before Thanksgiving.
They have to bring it back. We need Babe Vogelbach for a full season.
Oh, my gosh. I forgot all about him.
Yeah, we didn't even mention him. I mean, not, you know, there was one short-term move that worked out fabulously. And he has the potential. People are already saying he looks like the Barrel Man logo, the original Brewers logo. So he has potential for huge cult following. And if they have the DH, you can, and they have control of his contract too. So if they have the DH, Mr. Vogelbach will be back next year. I think we can safely say that.
In the meantime, we'll be watching playoff baseball. A lot of former Brewers. You mentioned Jesus Aguilar. We've talked about Trent Grisham. That Marlins team with all the prospects that were traded for Christian Yelich. Brandon Kinsler's on that team. G-Man Choi on the Rays. Yeah. Drew Pomeranz. There's a lot of former Brewers who are going to be involved. Eric Kratz isn't on the Yankees roster, but he's in the dugout. Right. So there's at least that to look forward to if Brewers fans are scratching for anything. And then a very interesting offseason. Very difficult to know what comes next. So we will certainly circle back with another podcast when there are some moves to discuss. But in the meantime, thanks for tuning in. Thanks, guys. Really appreciate you joining me.
Thanks, JR.
JR, a pleasure as always.
Find the Brewers Journal Sentinel podcast on Stitcher, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Leave us a rating and review. Thanks for tuning in this season. We will be back, like I said, as news allows. We'll talk to you then.